This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Good morning. Welcome to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you this morning, coming to you from the studios at KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. Today, I'd like to bring to your attention an article that was in the Wall Street Journal. And I'm probably going to bring you the whole article because I was very moved by it. Ian Johnson is the journalist. And title of the article, and this was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal yesterday, Poems in Tears for Silent Mentors Spark a Surge of Cadavers in Taiwan. Maybe some of you saw this. Medical students bond with families to quell traditional resistance to donating bodies. A fascinating article. And so here it is. I think I'm going to bring it to you in its entirety. A young medical student stood in front of a corpse as sobbing filled the operating room. The aspiring doctor, Xu Junkai, worked up the nerve to glance at the relatives crying next to him. Tears trickled down his own cheeks, but the surgery was not a failure. It hadn't even begun. Mr. Xu was taking part in an elaborate farewell for eight people who had donated their bodies to Tsuchi University's medical school for use in a surgery simulation class. Medical schools around the world have ceremonies to honor donors, but Tsuchi is taking the practice to unusual levels. Actually, Tsuchi is pronounced Segi, says the article. Segi. By the time students here wield their scalpels, they will know the dead intimately, composing poems and slideshows to them, writing their biographies, and sometimes lighting incense in their honor. When they are finished, the students will carry the donors' coffins to the crematory, mourning them as their silent mentors who taught them with their bodies. The reason for such care lies in the origins of Mr. Xu's university. Segi is the brainchild of one of Asia's most charismatic religious figures, Cheng Yin, a 72-year-old Buddhist nun who in the 1960s founded the Buddhist Compassion Relief Segi Foundation. Now the Chinese-speaking world's largest non-governmental charity. It last year channeled more than $300 million in private donations to victims of natural disasters around the world. Let me give you that number again. $300 million. A single non-governmental foundation. Ms. Chang has broader ambitions. In the 1970s and 80s, Tseh Gyi was part of a social and religious awakening in Taiwan that helped undermine the island's dictatorship and helped usher in democracy. The cadaver program is aimed at changing how traditional Chinese society in Taiwan and China views the human body, and in the process, end a body deficit plaguing Taiwanese medical schools. Traditionally, Chinese view their bodies as a bequeathal from their ancestors. This means bodies must not be damaged before burial. At Tseh Gyi, therefore, Ms. Chang insists that, unlike in Western medical schools, cadavers be sutured after being cut up. The laborious process takes days, but in the end, the body is whole. Ms. Chang also makes a more profound pitch to potential donors. Society needs you. It is an argument that has deeply touched Taiwanese, whose economic miracle of the past decades has left some morally unmoored. More than 23,500 Taiwanese have willed their bodies to Tseh Gyi. That number again, 23,500 Chinese have willed their bodies to Tseh Gyi, allowing the hospital to satisfy its educational needs and supply other schools on the island. Following Tseh Gyi's lead, other schools have implemented similar commemorative services, eliminating the shortage of corpses that long hindered the Taiwanese medical establishment. The public was conservative about corpse donation, but Tseh Gyi has made the public more open-minded, says Liu Koshan, director of the National Taiwan University's Graduate Institute of Anatomy and Cell Biology. Tseh Gyi changed that mindset with the power of religion. At first, medical professionals also viewed the efforts skeptically. Seng Guofeng was one of them, formerly head of anatomy at National Taiwan University's Medical School. Mr. Tseng did not see the point in the elaborate efforts to treat the bodies with so much respect. But after agreeing to teach courses at Tseh Gyi, he came to appreciate it and eventually took a senior posting at the school. I was trained as a hardcore scientist, and this did not make much sense to me, says Mr. Tseng. But I began to see that there's more to teaching a student than just technical ability. We need to create compassionate doctors, too. The efforts are spreading to China, where hospitals are also chronically short of corpses. 9 of the students in the February workshop in Hualien were from Shanghai. Western observers have been likewise impressed. It's something that we can learn from, said Sylvia Cruess, former director of medical services at McGill University in Montreal, who recently witnessed one of the Tseh Gyi ceremonies. The farewell ritual begins anew each summer before classes begin. When students like Mr. Xu fan out from Hualien, a small city on the rocky coast of eastern Taiwan, to visit the donors' families. After a 2-hour ride, Mr. Xu and 2 classmates arrived at the home of Li Xiu Yui, a 62-year-old who died of septic shock brought on by diabetes. Ms. Li Xiu had asked that her body be donated to Tseh Gyi, which froze it for use in a surgery simulation class. You want the family to understand what we're doing so they feel part of it, Mr. Xu said. We also learned about teacher Li Xiu. We got to know her as a person. In late February, Ms. Li Xiu's body was unfrozen along with the other seven bodies to be used in a surgery simulation, one of four such workshops the school holds every year. The night before the workshop was to start, some of the school's 350 medical students gave PowerPoint presentations about the lives of each donor to school staff and family members. When Mr. Xu's group was up, a classmate showed pictures of Ms. Li Xu, accompanied by a poem written by the classmate. Like a warm lantern in our heart, like the supple light of the moon, to embrace you forever in the fragrance of a flower, we will remember you forever. Then Jeff Sun, head of the Segi Hospital Surgery Department, addressed the relatives. The students are right next to you. They know how dear the departed are to you. They will treat them with respect. The next day at dawn, Mr. Xu stood, clad in a white uniform and surrounded by classmates, in a small bright shrine on the university campus. Across the aisle were about 30 family members of eight donors. After a short service of Buddhist prayers, the two sides filed into the operating room. On a screen at the head of each of the eight operating tables was a photo of the deceased. Slowly, family members broke down. Some prostrated themselves over the bodies, wailing. Others stood silently, sobbing. Like many of the other medical students, Mr. Xu's face began to turn red. He bit his lip as it started to quiver. His eyes welled up with tears. Across the table from him, Ms. Li Xu's daughter, Xu Yuichen, looked at him appreciatively before everyone trooped out and the service concluded with more prayers. As family members headed home, Mr. Xu and his classmates went back in to begin their work. 4 days later, the surgery workshop ended, and all reunited for the final funeral. The bodies were taken to a crematorium, and the remains put in cut glass urns donated to Segi by one of the island's most popular craftsmen, Heinrich Wong. This was her will, to let the students learn from her body, said Ms. Xu as she prepared to make her way back home to Hong Kong. And maybe now I can accept it. That's from yesterday's Wall Street Journal, April 22nd. Tremendous journalistic work by Ian Johnson. And I would dare say that not only do the dead whose bodies are donated for learning receive greater respect in Taiwan, but I suspect that in time, Taiwan will have a better healthcare system because of this. We'll be back in just a moment. This is the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold. Thank you. Welcome back to the New Capital Show, www.newcapitalshow.com. Just a couple of other comments I'd like to make about that article. I frequently have people who come to see me in the course of my work, and one common complaint that I hear is my work is not fulfilling. I had someone in the office yesterday who doesn't hate his job, but doesn't love it. And I frequently hear expressions like, I wish my work was... I wish my work was more life-changing. I wish my work helped contribute to the world more. I wish my work helped change the world. And I hear this about almost every variety of work that that exists. In the case yesterday, this was an attorney. And I think that one of the main things that I get from the article about the ceremonies performed prior to laboratory work done on cadavers to teach medical students is that any profession can be reinvented. Any job, any work can be reinvented. It all depends upon the mindset. And this is what I told the gentleman yesterday. It all depends on the mindset that is brought to the work. Who would have thought that the business of teaching medical students using cadavers would be imbued with such deep meaning for those students? What it took was a visionary, in this case, I guess the founder of Segi University and its teachers and leaders. It took visionaries to bring a different mindset to that work. The work remains, on the face of it, the same. Scalpels, cadavers. You know, the kind of work that probably a lot of people crinkle their nose at and make jokes about. I think I've heard that medical students in our country nickname their cadavers, you know, Bob, even though they have a name. How different the process at Segi University, where the students refer to their cadavers as silent mentors. Master. Teacher. The work is the same, but the mindset of the workers is different. And that's the way it is with all work. Any job can be the greatest job, and any job, any work can be the worst. The vast majority of the time, and there are a few exceptions, but the vast majority of the time, it has to do with how the worker approaches the work. And that is what I told the gentleman yesterday, actually, before I'd read the article. Now the article makes me believe that even more. You're working in a chemical company. You think that work is not important. You think it's hurting the earth. Bring a different spirit to it. Help the company change the way it's doing things. the world needs chemicals. We're never not going to need chemicals. There's a right way to do chemicals and a wrong way to do chemicals. There's a right way to do logging and a wrong way to do logging. There's a soulful, passionate, human way to do it, in an empty, heartless, pitiless, merciless, and alienated way to do it. Very often it's not the work, it's us. If Segi University can transform the process of cutting up cadavers, then we can transform the process of any work that we do. It just takes respecting the work. My college sends me an election ballot. For the Board of Trustees. I went to one of these Eastern colleges, and serving on the board there is a big honor. And it's fairly competitive to run for the board and get elected to the board, you know, and people tend to be very highly credentialed and accomplished, perhaps even to a fault. And sometimes there's a whiff of, you know, this is one more notch on their belt. And I have to admit that I have not really cast my ballot in many years. I kind of open it, kind of look at it, and then I've just gotten too busy. And for some reason, after I read this article last night, went home and had dinner, and the kids were already asleep, and my wife had something else. It was just me and the food. And I'm one of these people who, if I'm eating alone, sometimes I'll do that, but sometimes I'll want to read something. Which is probably not a great habit. You know, what am I escaping? Wouldn't it be better to sit and mindfully eat? But in any case, I was going to go for the newspaper. And I said, wait. Why don't you go for the trustee ballot? Why don't you read the profiles of the people who have put themselves forward for election for the Board of Trustees for your college? There are three candidates. There's one position open. Why don't you read what each of these people has written about themselves? Why don't you vote for trustee for your college? Why don't you do it with care and concern? Why don't you show, you being me, why don't I show respect for the effort that has gone into forming a board of trustees, maintaining a board of trustees, electing a board of trustees, sending ballots to everybody? Why don't you show the proper respect? And rather than reaching for the newspaper for more news, which is due its own respect, and I tried to give it such this morning, why not read the ballot? And I did that. 3 extraordinarily gifted people. One, the child of a Bangladeshi immigrant, first to go to college, extraordinarily accomplished, has begun non-governmental projects in health, poverty, across the world, degreed. Another, a judge and regulator of the financial industry in the state of Maryland. Another, a Dutch-born CEO of one of the world's largest hotel conglomerates. I couldn't decide. I sat there and I said, I don't know how to vote. All 3 of these people, look at the tremendous accomplishments, the way they have described themselves. The board needs to expand, needs all 3 of these people. I still haven't voted. Because I really don't know how to vote. And in a way, I feel that even if I am not able to bring myself to vote for one of these people, all 3 of whom impress me so enormously, I will still have done my job in stopping what I was doing, wolfing down food, putting aside the paper, and paying attention and paying respect. Ah, Board of Trustees, here it comes again. They send this thing to me every year. What a pain in the butt. It's just more junk mail. I graduated there 20 years ago. If they don't send me this, they want money. You know, if that's my approach to the work, then the result that I will engender and be engendering, the karma, will be that. But if I say these 3 people are putting themselves, and believe me, it's not easy to put yourself into nomination or accept a nomination to serve on something. It's not easy. Time constraints. You have to be prepared to lose if it's something that you would like to win. Not easy. And for me to take the time and the respect to give a few minutes to that process, I'm engendering something into the world, unseen, intangible, unspoken, but nevertheless, very, very real. What they're doing at Segi University should be a model for how to rebuild American institutions, which are currently struggling with that very question. How do we rebuild a healthcare system? How do we rebuild an energy system, an education system, financial system, infrastructure? And the answer is shown to us by the medical students at Segi. The article was on the bottom, below the fold of the Wall Street Journal. And the big news is the probe of the Bush officials is possible. Obama may let it go forward. Companies spying into declines in earnings. But the real news on the cover of the Wall Street Journal on April 22nd was below the fold. And it was about a group of medical students and a university showing how to bring respect to work. You want a better system? You want a better medical system, you want a better healthcare system, whatever system it is, you must begin by paying respect to the work. And not just the movements of the work, the using the scalpel, but you must begin by paying proper memorial to the cadavers who made the decision while alive to give their bodies for your learning. Respect to the instruments, the tools, the process, the work, all of it. And only then will you be entitled to a great system. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Dan is holding. Dan, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hello. I'm a physician in the Houston area, and I thank you for bringing up the example of Taiwan. In fact, Taiwan is an excellent example for us. They have a wonderful single-payer program for providing universal health care to all citizens. And I hope that you'll bear with me just for a couple minutes. I would like to describe a recent article in the New Republic. Jonathan Cole interviewed Dr. Michael Chen, who's vice president of Taiwan's National Health Program. And there's a couple of very revealing statements in here. Jonathan Cole asks Dr. Chen, how did you go in the direction of single payer? And Dr. Chen said, we sent our people around the world to learn their programs, including the United States. Actually, the program is modeled after Medicare in the United States. So they expanded and improved our model for covering the elderly to include their entire population. Then next, Jonathan Cole says, now, one issue that comes up in the United States when people talk about a single-payer program, the big concern is there's not enough choice. People in America, we want to know that you can choose the kind of insurance you want, how much coverage, what services. Is this an issue in Taiwan? And Dr. Chen says, not at all, because in Taiwan, the benefit package is rather comprehensive. We maintain a very long list for prescription drugs, more than 20,000 items. The benefit package includes inpatient, outpatient, dental service, which is not usually covered. Then Jonathan Cole says, now the flip side is if you're offering such a generous package, that's very expensive, isn't it? Dr. Chen says, not the case. Jonathan Cole is surprised. Not the case? Well, what percentage of GDP? 6% of GDP. So that's very affordable. So, in other words, in Taiwan, they offer comprehensive, one-tier, high-class, universal health care to every citizen. They spend 6% of GDP for that. It's much more comprehensive than the United States. In the United States, we spend 16.4% of GDP, and we have at least 100 million uninsured and underinsured. So Jonathan Cole says, in this country, we spend far more than that. Are there waiting times for services in Taiwan? Is there something that people are going without? Dr. Chen says, no waiting lines. Jonathan Cole is flabbergasted. No waiting lines? I can see a doctor any day I want. And Michael Chen says, you can even visit a specialist in a matter of minutes.
Yeah. Thank you for this. There was a Frontline, the tremendous
right
documentary series that's presented on PBS
right
that was entitled
Healthcare Around the World.
Healthcare Around the World. You may have seen this.
Yeah.
And the correspondent, Hedrick Smith, visited 4, 5, 6 countries and brought to U.S. viewers a profile of each of those countries, and one of them was Taiwan. And
right.
And what came out of that is exactly what you are saying that they have a that the Taiwanese undertook a very careful analysis of other healthcare systems in the world. They studied them, and then they adopted what they felt were the best aspects of each of those, and then implemented that system in Taiwan. And the system apparently is highly successful, and as you point out, is a fraction, half, let's say, of the cost.
Much less than half, as a matter of fact.
Fraction, one-third to one-half or so,
right,
of GDP in Taiwan. And so and so I think it's no coincidence, exactly, I think the point you're making, no coincidence that it would be in Taiwan that these teaching memorials would be implemented.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot to learn from the rest of the world.
Just one other comment. I think that the U.S. population needs to continue to ask itself, how is it that two-thirds of the population can, in poll after poll, be for single-payer national health care insurance, improved and expanded Medicare for all, with delivery remaining private? Two-thirds of the population supports that, yet people like Max Baucus and Senator Edward Kennedy are saying it's not politically possible. You know, that's a rhetorical question. The answer is obviously people like Max Baucus find it difficult to resist the bribery of the lobbyists from the big insurance companies. And so what we have in the United States is the fox and the hen house. The foxes, of course, are primarily private insurance companies who are stealing the system blind, and as a consequence have made healthcare a commodity which some people can afford, some people can't, based on ability to pay, not on need. And this is among 59% of physicians support a single payer healthcare program in the United States, and this is really amazing, because physicians tend to be a very conservative, even reactionary group. And this tells you how bad things have gotten, even among this extremely conservative group, physicians, that 59% would support single payer. This is Annals of Internal Medicine 2008. Unfortunately, we're the only industrialized country in the world who doesn't have some form of universal health care, and who has a for-profit system which is causing enormous pain and suffering. 20,000 deaths every year in the United States due to lack of insurance. We rank it's a myth,
yep,
that the U.S.
Yep.
has the best health care in the world.
Dan, thanks,
yeah,
for the call. It's great to have you.
You bet. Thank you.
Got a couple of energy items I want to bring to your attention. This is obviously is turning into a health care show, which is fine. Kind of show does what the show does. Everybody's got a story. I mean, I've got one from about 2 weeks ago. The insurance that I carry, I'm self-employed, and the insurance that I carry is a so-called HSA, health savings account plan. It's a high deductible plan. There's no copays. And so my family and I are responsible for basically every dollar until we hit a deductible. What we do get is we're in the network, and so we get the network price for procedures and things. But I could personally be liable for $5,000 and my children $5,000. I mean, it could be $10,000-$15,000 a year on top of the $5,000 in premiums, $20,000 out of pocket before the insurance company kicks in anything. So what we basically have is a major medical problem policy, and that's by design. That's what we've elected to do. And so when we go into the doctor, we ask lots of questions. What is beforehand? What is it that is going to be done, and what is it going to cost? And I went in. I've been having a problem in my leg, and I went in to see a neurologist, and I asked at the front desk, what will be the charge for the services today? And I was told $250 or $300 something, and I said, okay. And I went in, and I saw the doctor, and they did this, and they did that, and uh, just He asked me some questions. He did some reflex, you know, tapping on my knee and my ankle to see what's there. And then he left the room, and he came back in and said, okay, now we're going to run some tests using some electrical shock procedure. It's in the other room. You need to get up and come in this other room. I said, okay. And we went in. We did that. It wasn't pleasant, you know. I basically got, you know, shocked. And and then he said, well, okay, now we need to send you for an MRI. And I said, I said, okay, and I'm assuming that's gonna cost more. And he said, yeah, that's gonna cost more, and you talk about that up at the front desk. I went up to the front desk. They said, we want to now send you for an MRI. I said, that's gonna cost more. How much more? They said, $500 more. I said, okay, well, I'd like to pay the bill right now as it currently stands. It's $250, $300, as I understand it. That's what I was told. They said, oh, no, it's $1,500. I said, what do you mean? I asked at the front desk. Before I went in, she said, let me go check. She came back, said it was going to be $250, $300. And you're now telling me that what the doctor did, the initial testing of my reflexes with the hammer, and then the applying the shocks to my leg for 10 minutes or so, the charge is $1,500. What do you mean? Oh, the $250, $300 was just for the doctor to ask you the questions. I said, well, you didn't tell me that when I was leaving the room to go in for the electric shocks, it was going to be $1,200 for 10 minutes of shocking me. Had you told me that, I would have said, well, please tell me about this procedure and how necessary is it, and is there another procedure that would tell you more? And they said, well, yeah, the MRI would tell us more. And I said, well, had you told me that, I just would have said, let's skip shocking me and let's go to the MRI, and so on and so forth. So, yes, everybody has their stories. I have one from last week. The system is a mess. And you can't even get I chalked it up to lack of communication or whatever, although I thought I was communicating fine in the doctor's office. In my opinion, it begins with a profound lack of respect. That doctor's office profoundly disrespected my request to tell me what was my financial liability for being looked at. I appreciate the doctor very much and the expertise. I thought he was a very good doctor with a good bedside manner, very nice. But they're obviously out to lunch when somebody comes in with a high deductible plan and says, I'd like to know what you're going to charge me today. 10 minutes after telling someone $300, they're in for $1,500. And so it goes. Real quick before we get back to the phones, just... I want to bring you some good news today. I feel like I brought you some good news with the information on the medical school. Something's wrong with my computer today. Speaking of, I think my computer's got a virus. I can't even pull up the article. I'll just have to read you the headlines. Time for a new computer. Texas moves to foster solar power. This is today, Wall Street Journal on Tuesday. I'm going to paraphrase the news. I've already read it, so I'll see if I can remember it. The Texas, I think the Senate has passed legislation which is going to boost solar power in Texas. 30% of that is going to go for direct residential applications, people to apply them to their houses. The remainder of it's going to go to, I guess, wholesale generation for large utilities to put in large solar plants. And I'm not a big fan of subsidies. I don't like to see subsidies. But until we get proper costing for fossil fuels, until we apply taxes for the costs of fossil fuels, the only thing we can do is to grant subsidies to alternative energy. I'd like to see no subsidies anywhere. I think alternative energy can stand on its own in Texas and anywhere. But to do it, you've got to include all the costs of fossil fuels. And those guys spend all their time, not all their time, but a lot of their time, fighting against assessing the right costs. We're starting to get news on that. EPA clears the way for warming of gases. This was very big news. Basically, the EPA... under the Bush administration refused to recognize carbon dioxide as a pollutant. The EPA now, under the Obama administration, is now working to clear the way for regulation of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. It's good news. What it means is that even though subsidies are being granted to solar here in Texas, at the same time, there is a cinching down on costs. We're on our way to cinching down costs. The two ideas bandied about, of course, are a tax on carbon, which I favor. I think that's the better way to go about it, or a cap-and-trade carbon trading system, which is what is favored by the Obama administration, which to me is a lot messier, but it's better than nothing. This has been my mantra, as it were, on the Obama administration. It's better than nothing, and it's better than what came before. So, you know, take it easy. Don't take it easy, just take it calmly. New York Times reports that offshore wind is getting a major boost as well from the Obama administration. The Obama administration is about to make available, I guess, offshore districts, offshore quadrants that are under federal regulation in terms of their use for the construction of wind turbines off the coast. I know there are some problems with that. There's some issues. But it's better than nothing. And it's better than coal. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of change going on. I assure you of that. A lot of good change going on. Not perfect change. There's no such thing. But there's a lot of good change going on. A lot of good change on its way. I'm reasonably satisfied. I'm certainly more satisfied than I was 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 years ago. Those were dark years. I don't want to go back to those years, and I don't think we are. Let's take John on line one. John, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Is that me?
That's you. You're on.
Okay. Well, one thing, one little correction was it wasn't Hedrick Smith. It was T.R. Reid.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Thank you, John.
Secondly, I think the reason people are unhappy about their work is that they aren't really serving anybody but corporate capital. The real reasons for their work is to increase corporate capital's profits. We've allowed most of the business of this country to be controlled by corporate capital, and
I disagree, John.
I figure you disagree because otherwise you wouldn't be saying some of the things you say. But corporations, their main, they get too big, mm-hmm. and they're allowed to get too big, and they have been allowed to get too big. And one of their main things is to monopolize their field of endeavor, and they do that either by driving other businesses out of business or buying them up, and they've been allowed to buy them up, and now we have corporations too big to fail, and that's why people are unhappy, because what they're doing is they're working to increase the profit of a corporation. And I know you don't necessarily agree with that, but that's what I think.
Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. I'm not disagreeing. I don't disagree that entities should be regulated. I've never said that. I've been a staunch proponent of regulation forever. I don't think you can have a system of capital without regulation. No system of capital. And don't kid yourself that if you had a socialist system, you wouldn't have capital. You cannot have an economic system without capital. So capital will aggrandize to different entities that control the levers of the economy or have products that are persuasive and popular. It's just how it is. You don't think that capital aggrandized in the Soviet Union to the communist leaders there? And I'm not saying that that's the only model of socialist capital endeavor, because it's not. Believe me, I know it's not. I attend the Houston Zen Center, and I see groups of people working together in cooperation and in social harmony all the time. But we can't just say people don't like their work because they're working for a corporation. You know? There are people who like their work working for corporations and like their work not working for them. There are people who don't like their work working for corporations, people who don't like their work not working for corporations. So I take your point, John. I understand your point, but I don't think that it gets at the root cause of how people approach their work. Nor do I think you're going to get rid of corporate capital. You can put regulations on corporations, and we should. And we shouldn't have organizations that are too big to fail. I agree with that. And there is now discussion about that. Joseph Stiglitz and others appeared before Congress a couple days ago, making the argument that we have to break up large banks. If that argument is persuasive, and if the model based in that argument is correct, fine. Let's pass the laws. But we're not going to get rid of capital, and we're not going to get rid of corporations. And nor do I think that that is a productive endeavor. What I think is a productive endeavor is to pass laws that make our system work and pass regulations. And that's what's been wrong for the past decades. There have been no rules, and you cannot have any system that doesn't have rules and regulations. And regulations are not anathema to capitalist systems. They are required in capitalist systems. You cannot have a capitalist system without regulations. Right? There's no such thing. It becomes a boundaryless, indefinable entity. But how people approach their work is a different question. And if you work for a corporation and you don't like how things are going, change it. Come into work and say, this is my vision. And change other people who you work with. Let's take Bobby on line two. Bobby, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Well, I've told people, corporate and otherwise, my vision, that's why I'm unemployed, okay? I don't think that the companies are... Large companies are too big to fail. They're too big not to fail. The largeness almost guarantees their failure. They're unmanageable, and they're unregulatable. And the reason is that instead of being a big old corporation, what they did is they've assumed the smallest posture they can, which is a First Amendment person. So once they have the Constitution... And it's only them who get to exercise their constitutional rights 90% of the time. If you go one-on-one, me or them, they're going to win. So they've assumed my role in the Commonwealth, the government, the country. And it's ironic or it's paradoxical that by assuming an individual's right, they become a government. And that's what the problem is, having unlimited First Amendment and other constitutions. The Bill of Rights belongs to corporations. It's been incorporated. And that has to be fixed, really fixed. before you'll really see any restraint on lobbying and also the, you know, the way campaigns are financed. That's very, very basic. And as far as health care goes, I've had a couple of friends in the last year, if they'd had proper health care, they'd be alive today. It's unreasonable that we have to pay three times what other people pay, and yet the dogma and the propaganda is that other countries have worse health care. I don't know anybody who has worse health care than nothing,
yeah,
which is what a lot of us have, a third of us have.
Bobby, thanks for the call.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's take Tony up next. Tony, welcome to the show. Tony? Yes, we lost him again. Johnny, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hey, Leo, long time no see.
Yeah, I haven't heard from you in a while. How's it going?
I hope your legs gets better. I'll pray for you.
Thank you.
My holistic approach. In this lopsided capitalistic system that we have here, the way it's practiced, it's no surprise to me that from day one when you're in elementary school, when they tell you buyer beware at every turn, that when you go to the doctor's office and have an encounter with the front office as you did, that it's a valuable teaching tool. It makes you realize that you have to think and speak like a lawyer. And it's not that I'm necessarily coming to their defense. I'm not defending those people in medicine at all, because I have lots of issues with the way we practice medicine. But I'm thinking on one side of it, many sides, is that they are, they're in business. They have a bottom line. They have bills to pay to. And they're thinking, we don't want to turn away this customer, so let's just give them a piece of the truth. Let's tell them what it's going to cost, but not tell them exactly what it is it's going to cost them. And it's not just for medicine. It's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of different ways we make a living. You go to the automobile dealership, you have the same problem. Used car dealerships, big problem. A lot of, and you know, and so it's no surprise to me that the legal profession and the medical profession, they have a lot in common. So
yeah, I mean, Johnny, really, to get back to the article on the Taiwanese medical school, I mean, this is my point, is that really it doesn't matter. You know, we can talk corporations or not corporations, but really it comes down to cultural issues. Do we have a nation of honest people?
That's
the question. If you have a nation of honest people, you'll have a nation of honest corporations. If you have a nation of honest people, you'll have a nation of honest doctors and so forth. So,
well, the only way to get to a nation of honest people is you have to dehomogenize the process.
Yeah.
We homogenize everything we do.
Johnny, got to run.
Original everybody. That's the problem.
We're out of time.
Okay. Good luck with your leg. Bye.
This Tuesday, Michael Clare is appearing at St. Thomas University. I'll be introducing him 7 p.m. this Tuesday. That's April 28th. April 28th, Michael Clare will also be at the Rice Cinema the day after that. So hope to see you there. www.newcapitalshow.com. Great to be with you. And back next week. Until then, take care.
Buy a ticket for KPFT's 39th birthday car raffle. A 2005 Mercury Grand Marquis GS with only 20,000 actual miles on it could be yours for a mere $20. Your raffle ticket purchase will go towards supporting KPFT's programming, and if you win, it should be the cheapest vehicle purchase you'll ever make. You can buy tickets at KPFT's offices, 419 Lubbock Boulevard in Montrose, weekdays between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m., or stop your favorite KPFT on-air personality or local station board member. They should have tickets. Raffle rules can be found at our website, kpft.org. If it's your style to put things off until the last minute, we'll be selling raffle tickets at the International Festival at our booth and also during the Art Car Parade on Saturday, May 9th. The drawing for this car will be held immediately after the Art Car Parade. You don't want to miss out on KPFT's 39th birthday car raffle. This is KPFT Houston.
Mark your calendar for the Houston International Festival, coming your way April 18th, 19th, 25th, and 26th. The 2009 festival will showcase Ireland and will feature performances by Los Lobos, Mavis Staples, Hugh Masekela, Ohio Players, Marsha Ball, Flaco Jimenez, Cherish the Ladies, and many, many more. Want more details? Go to ifest.org to see the complete schedule and purchase tickets. You can also sign up to volunteer for this fun-filled event at ifest.org. Don't miss the Houston International Festival April 18th, 19th, 25th, and 26th. Go to ifest.org and get your tickets today. This is KPFT, Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.